The Athletic.
Totally Football Show today. It wasn't 1963, but it did feature a 6-3. We round up the bumper Boxing Day action in the Premier League. From Arsenal's young'uns enjoying Odegaard like they just got a link set from their aunt, to Man City's Leicester City stuffing, to Spurs Palace. All the reviews saying skip, like Mrs. Brown's boy's Christmas special. Plus, we look ahead to the midweek action in the Premier League and more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. All right then, December 27th. Listener, so glad we got that Christmas thing out the way. Can get back to the real business of opinionating on football matches, some of which have been played, others not so much. Daniel Storey's here with us today. Hello, Daniel.
Good morning, James.
Good morning to you. Tom Williams, also present.
Good morning, James. Season's greetings.
Oh, yeah. Very nice of you, Tom. Thank you. And also to Lindsay Hooper.
Good morning. Hope you've all had a lovely Christmas.
Well, that's so sweet of you. You join us from the in-laws today, Lindsay.
I do. I'm in the spare room.
All right, then.
Hidden away. I think you're in your spare room, though, aren't you, James?
I don't like to think it's spare. It's the place where I do these podcasts. So for me, it's very much the beating heart of my so-called life. Anyway, joining us from the spare room is an experience, Lindsay, that will resonate probably with loads of listeners. Perhaps you, listener, are in someone's spare room even now, in which case, good luck to you. Good luck to you, Lindsay, talking Wolves today. That's going to be a stretch, but I have faith. Daniel, meantime, you're about to head off to AFCON.
Yes, it felt like about five things needed to drop into place for that to happen maybe a fortnight ago, and I think at least two or three of those things have dropped into place. So, yeah, I've got the advantage of only going out for the quarterfinals, semis and final, which means I can kind of see if it gets cancelled halfway through the tournament before.
I was just about to say, it's definitely happening then.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it is definitely happening. My big suspicion and fear is that fairly high-profile players suddenly come down with injuries and or COVID that stops them journeying to Africa for the tournament, but we'll see.
All right. You're one of that select band of people who are happy it's going ahead, Daniel.
Yeah, I am. I really am. I think in Europe, I understand why, because of this kind of dominating mania of elite club football, but this is their European Championships, which is a really obvious thing to say, but if you remember how happy and excited and joyous we all were at England's progress in that competition, it seems a bit rum to then say, well, yeah, but this one's just a fly in our ointment.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, let's have a little bit of a discussion about what ointment there's been to put flies in over the past 24 hours. Boxing Day saw six matches, one still to come on Monday before the midweek round begins. Saints won 3-2 at West Ham. That's the Hammers' fourth defeat in their last five. Spurs made short work of Crystal Palace 3-0, while Arsenal equaled their biggest ever Premier League away winning margin 5-0 at Carrow Road. Man City and Leicester combined for the highest scoring Boxing Day game in Premier League history, 6-3. Lukaku's return saw Chelsea beat Aston Villa 3-1 and Brighton beat Brentford 2-0. There you go. Ooh, highest scoring Boxing Day game in Premier League history. Let's hear about that.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
The Forts! Oh, they needed that. A nerve settler from Aymeric Laporte.
Man City 6, Leicester City 3, and Lindsay Hooper, you were there.
I know, I felt like I got the golden ticket. A proper Boxing Day feast for me and for many others that were there. It was everything. It was everything that you could possibly imagine. I've not seen anything like this in a game of football. At 4-0 at half time, James, I was thinking this is going to be a 9-0 again. And for once, Leicester will be on the receiving end. And then they came out after the break. Brendan Rodgers shifted to that back five, made a substitute as well, bringing Castagna on. And there was this spell where in 10 minutes they scored three goals, all counter-attacking, beautifully worked goals as well. And the away end was singing, we're going to win 5-4. And there was part of me thinking, I believe them at that point. However, I should have seen the bigger picture, which I'm sure from listening to this show, everyone would know when we've spoken in the past as well in recent weeks about Leicester's defence and the way they have an inability to defend corners or set pieces. Mm. And that was their undoing ultimately in the end. But 6-3, 9 goals, I couldn't believe it.
Mm. Duncan Alexander pointing out that in this game alone, Leicester scored 25% of all the goals that City have conceded this season, yet they still lost by 3 goals. Remarkable stuff. Daniel, they do this a lot, City, and they've now scored, 17 goals in the last 3 games. They've had 9 league victories in a row. What new can you tell us about this performance?
Well, the handy thing they've picked up in recent weeks is scoring very early, which before this game was a kind of sign that the game's over. We're just going to control it from this point on and probably score 1, maybe even 2 more goals. I think last season they scored 12 goals in the first 12 or 13 minutes of games, and they're already up to 11 this season with only half the season played. So that's kind of a new thing for them. But there is this sort of vague theory that because they're so good, that the only thing that can really beat Manchester City this season is Manchester City. And in that 10-minute period, you kind of saw why, in that Guardiola sort of started gesticulating when they conceded 1 and then got more and more animated as the second and third goals went in. And then they decided to start playing again and Leicester stopped defending from set pieces. But I do think there's a kind of fair theory in that. If City play to their best and concentrate all the time, they will win the league. The one thing I'd say about Sunday is that I think having Rodri there just enables them to control the game so much in a way that Fernandinho has been brilliant over the years, but the recovery pace just isn't quite there anymore. So Rodri is almost, I think, probably their most important and influential player, in that he just kind of dictates the tempo and calms everyone down a bit when they do lack a bit of composure in defence.
Yeah, Rodri wasn't in the matchday squad, and we asked about that before kickoff. The only thing that we were told, the official line from the club, is that he wasn't fully fit. Now, that might be a COVID issue. They didn't say that. It could be. But one of the points that I was going to make is how well Man City have handled the pandemic. I mean, if you look at the way that some of these teams have been decimated, and we know the squad depth that City have got already, that is another huge advantage, I think, James, going into the new year and in this title race, is that they haven't really lost many players in a period where other teams have lost quite a lot.
Indeed, they've actually left out players who were fit because of disciplinary issues. Tom, did you buy Pep doing his sort of cosplaying concern thing when Leicester were on their comeback trail?
Well, I did actually, because Leicester have had a pretty good record against specifically Pep Guardiola's Manchester City. They won 5-2 at the Etihad at the beginning of last season when City was still getting themselves together. They've had a few other quite handsome wins. I think Guardiola's first season, Leicester really turned them over at the King Power Stadium. And I think Leicester are set up in a way that does cause this City team problems because they are so good on the counter-attack. Generally speaking, in recent seasons, it's been the pace of Jamie Vardy darting in behind. And I think Vardy's probably pretty high up the list of players who Guardiola fears coming up against the most. Obviously, he didn't start at the Etihad. But then we saw with Ademola Lookman and Maddison and Kelechi Iheanacho, who's become a little bit the forgotten man at Leicester, despite finishing last season in such great form, that even without Jamie Vardy on the pitch, Leicester still do have that counter-attacking pace. And I thought the first 2 goals in particular, with Maddison heavily involved, obviously involved in the third one as well, but really nicely constructed goals. And I think the problem that Leicester have got at the moment is they just don't have a defence. You look at the team that they lined up, or Brighton, Amarty, Vestergaard and Luke Thomas, if all their defenders are fit, none of those players start. So you're obviously going to be up against it, against a team with the kind of firepower that Man City boast. But the fact that they were able to score those 3 goals showed that they remain an attacking threat. James Maddison is obviously in a really good run of form at the moment. I feel like there's almost a bit of a kind of picture of Dorian Gray thing going on between James Maddison and Jack Grealish. There was definitely a time when we were wondering which of the two was going to become like England's main man. And obviously it ended up being Jack Grealish, and James Maddison had a bit of a forgettable season last season. But now Jack Grealish is on the naughty step and James Maddison is banging goals in from all over the place. So yeah, a bit of a knockabout game for Leicester. That vulnerability at set pieces that has haunted them all season, clearly caused them problems. But a few glimmers of hope in an attacking sense, I suppose, if you were looking for positives.
They got Liverpool next, Leicester, so that'll be another quiet one. Not
the other thing to say about City is that the theme of their season until the 7-0 Leeds win was that they were creating loads of chances and not really taking them. In the last two games, they've scored 10 times against Newcastle and Leicester from 35 shots, which is a really, really impressive rate. So if it turns out that Manchester City are suddenly going to become efficient finishers as well, then the rest of the Premier League really is in trouble, because they've had so many more shots than anyone else. I think 16 is their lowest in a game this season for shots, which is absolutely nonsense, really. So if they're going to start, whether it's using Sterling centrally or whether it's using, against Leicester, almost nobody centrally, just Sterling and Mahrez wide, and then everyone else just bombs through the middle, then yeah, everyone else is in a pickle.
Sterling afterwards, he was speaking to us for Premier League, and he did say that he thinks there's a psychological advantage now for Manchester City with Liverpool not playing on Boxing Day, because it's that 6-point gap. I mean, I put pretty much everything to him. The one thing that I didn't say, which I was thinking all the way through the match, because in front of my very eyes, I was thinking, I'm never going to see anything like this again. But there was one thing missing. And I have to say, it was the atmosphere. I felt like City was pretty quiet. And it might be that Boxing Day fixture where you get a few more families, which we like to see. But I just felt like at times they really needed a shot of something to get them really going. And then the away end was so loud. And when they were cheering as well, we're going to win 5-4, even that didn't seem to spark City into life for a while. It was only when they scored the third goal that really something kicked in the crowd. And I think that was the thing that was missing. But we didn't speak about that.
Was it full?
I think there were a few patches. I was looking around. I would be surprised. The figure that we got was over 53,000. But I was looking around thinking that there were some empty seats. It wasn't really bad. I've seen it worse.
You'll have the City fans on your case now, Lindsay.
I know. But you've just got to say as you find it. You know, I was there and I go to a lot of matches for different atmospheres, and it just surprised me, given what was happening in the game, that it wasn't louder.
Where's your favourite atmosphere, Lindsay, in the Premier League?
Molyneux.
Right.
I do love the atmosphere at Molyneux. I love the atmosphere at Anfield. I do think it's a great atmosphere. Spurs, now the way that they've designed that stadium with that big bank, you do feel the noise. Leicester City, actually, you know, if this was a reverse fixture and they were at the King Power.
Daniel's not having that, Lindsay.
No?
I wonder why.
Oh, because of the clappers.
Thank you very much.
Maybe that's what they need to do, give out a few clappers.
Well, yeah. Just on the subject of those early goals, Daniel, it's a really remarkable trend that you mentioned. But is that just kind of luck, or is there a tactics behind that? I mean, how do you say to your team, well, why don't we get a goal early instead? Because that might work better.
Yeah, I mean, I think Guardiola generally, firstly, the obvious thing to say is that pretty much every Premier League game they play, they have better players than their opponents, particularly at the moment. But I think Guardiola has always liked in potential title winning seasons to get to a place where City can try and relax over the last third of the game. And therefore, the earlier you score goals, the earlier that chance to relax comes. I mean, that kind of goes against what happened on Sunday. But yes, I think that's probably it. He likes to have a really early start, overpower an opponent who maybe hasn't quite settled yet, and then look to control the game from that point on. And yeah, they're doing it pretty well at the moment.
And I think a lot of that comes from just having such a clear identity. I mean, every time you watch City, they seem to settle so quickly because everyone knows what they're doing 2 or 3 minutes in, and they're already camped inside the opposition half. Their opponents can't get a touch. Every time that the man on the ball looks around, he has options around him. And I feel like I made this point quite a lot last season, but I think this specific iteration of Manchester City without a conventional number nine which basically came into being about a year ago. It was actually, was it Boxing Day, I think, last season when City sort of settled on this formula after a pretty sticky first half of the season. I think it stands comparison with almost anything that Guardiola's done in his entire coaching career. Just the quality of the football, the fact that City are able to score so many goals without a number nine. I mean, it is really, really revolutionary. What is it, 17 goals in the last three games, albeit against teams with quite leaky defences. And I think when you have a team where that sort of positional fluidity is so ingrained and the players are so comfortable in that system, it enables you to find your feet very quickly in games. And I think that's probably where a lot of those early goals come from.
So if you were the Championship manager, this City team against, say, the kind of golden era Pep Barca, you'd have this, you'd want to be doing this City team. That's
I would still go for Pep's Barca. But I think that when you take a step back and look at Guardiola's greatest teams, I think the tactical ingenuity required in the creation of this team is just very different to anything he's done at any of his previous clubs. They've currently scored 50 goals, City, which is the same as Liverpool, albeit City having played a game more. Liverpool are playing with one of the best front threes we've seen in recent Premier League history, with Mo Salah absolutely walking on water, and City are doing it without a conventional number nine. And, you know, some of the scorelines are just completely freakish.
I think that's the comparison, isn't it? When you look at City versus Liverpool in this title race, is that, and we'll soon see with AFCON, but you take some of the key players for Liverpool out of the system and there are potential gaps and there are potential opportunities for other teams to benefit. I think with City, what you have is a team that have found a real rhythm, and it doesn't matter who Pep picks in this system. And we saw, as James hinted at as well, a couple of key players who were in the bad books, Grealish and Foden, didn't even need them in this starting 11. They can just make it work, and that's why I think they're on a canter to the title this year. And hopefully we're cancelling all the chat about January and needing a number nine, because they obviously don't. Eight different goal scorers in this one, for instance. It's just incredible where the goals are coming from. It's all over the pitch.
Just as a kind of little statistical thing, I don't think you need statistics to prove that City are better now than they were in 2006-07, but they've scored as many home goals in the last 131 minutes at the Etihad as they did in the whole of that season at home, which is, if nothing else, is proof that Sterling, Silva and De Bruyne are better than Emil Mpenza, Samaras and Bernardo Corradi.
All right, proof at last. Excellent. Yeah.
At last we can put that debate to bed.
Speaking of players being omitted from the Man City squad, that looks like that Ferran Torres thing is happening. Him and his peoples are in Barcelona to sort out a €55 million deal plus €10 million add-on. Not sure what the add-on is about.
£55 million is quite a lot to find down the back of a sofa, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Is that pretty much double what City paid, nearly?
Yeah, they pay.
And they're not exactly even going to notice. I mean, any other team, a player like that, and he had been good for them, they'd be like, wow, you know,
remember
what
how
we're gonna
he
do
started
that
the season?
Us?
He was going to be their false nine. Yeah. Anyway, there you go. Remarkable stuff. Next up, they face Brentford, who lost 2-0 at Brighton. You want to predict a scoreline for that? How big do you think that's going to be, Tom?
I think it could potentially be quite big again, given that it's very easy for City to freshen things up. Yeah, Brentford's on a particularly good run. Obviously, they'd won at Watford just before. I think a couple of postponements, and then seemed to be pretty solidly second best against Brighton. Although they did finish the game quite strongly. But I think that the form that City are in, the depth in their squad, the quality of football they play, I think there's a strong chance it's going to be a long night for the Bees.
Double figures, you think?
I didn't say that, James.
Okay. It's the derby of the two sides that play Hey Jude when they win.
Yes, I do like Hey Jude. Well, this is the next game that I'm at.
Okay. Well, you'll enjoy that then.
Yeah, I feel like I'm following City around for Christmas, and that's literally it, because I hardly ever usually see them. But I think 5-0, James.
Okay, fair. I mean, it could be anything. It could even be a Brentford win. That's the magic of football. All right, so City with a win. Chelsea, meanwhile, maintaining their distance from the leaders with a victory at Villa. Let's talk about that next.
Hello, listeners. And just like that, it's all done, but there's plenty more eating and drinking over the next few days. And we saw Brendan Rodgers and his Foxes, they came out the wrong side of a 9-goal thriller at the Etihad on Boxing Day. And one would wonder whether the interest of Rodgers at Old Trafford has cooled somewhat after a run that has seen his Leicester win just 4 of the 15 games in all competitions since the beat United 4-2 back in October. Meanwhile, Jurgen Klopp would have been grinning ear to ear with the news that he got to spend most of the day with his family, and his Liverpool players would have fond memories of their trip to East Midlands back in 2019, when they made a massive stride towards lifting the title by winning 4-0 at the King Power. With a quick turnaround for the wounded Foxes and the Pool having enjoyed their feet up, it's no surprise that the Paddy Power traders, who will be stuffed to the gills at this point, listeners, have made the Merseysiders the odds-on favourites to win the match at 4-2-11. The Leicester win is quite a large 6-1 shot, and the draw is 4-1. One man who, we have to mention, he's been remarkable of late for the Foxes, and that's James Maddison. He has 6 goals in his last 8 in all comps. He's a massive 12-1 to score the first goal. Too much eggnog for the traders, I think. Fill your boots, Santa. You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or indeed the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s. T's and C's apply. BeGambleAware.org. And remember, take time to think.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Yep, Chelsea with a 3-1 victory Boxing Day away at Aston Villa. Once they'd remembered that they had a £100 million striker sitting on their bench, that was handy.
Wasn't it just, yeah. Lukaku spoke after the game to say he completely understood why Tuchel had left him on the bench recently, and he's had an injury and he's had COVID, so there are reasons to kind of go gently with him. But when you looked at that Chelsea starting team and the kind of very obvious lack of goals within it, and then you bring on a striker like Lukaku, it's so hard for central defenders. I mean, I thought Tyrone Mings was poor for the first goal, but when you've had a team that is not playing with a striker, and then suddenly they bring on, you know, perhaps the most obvious example of a number nine or in the Premier League, it's so hard to deal with because you're not used to those runs being made. You're not used to someone driving it with the ball at their feet. And I mean, this was absolutely vintage Lukaku. They do still need to find a way to get the ball to him more, because he won the game and he only had 18 touches in his 45 minutes. If the more touches you give Lukaku, the better he will play. But yeah, I mean, an absolute virtuoso half of him.
Maybe Aston Villa and playing Aston Villa is the key to Lukaku's form, because when he just arrived back at Chelsea, I remember being at Stamford Bridge for the 3-0 victory. And he was superb in that game, and he didn't need many touches. He was finishing. And then here we go. He pops up again, the reverse fixture, this time at Villa Park, in scoring form. So already 3 of his goals have come against Villa. And you wonder whether he will kick on now into the new year. I don't think my tip, though, at the start of the season of him being top Premier League goal scorer is going to come off. I think I might be retreating on that one.
We shall see. I mean, maybe Tuchel's going to build the side around him from now on as they go into an interesting run of games. Brighton on Wednesday, but then Liverpool and Man City. Absolutely huge matches in terms of Chelsea's title prospects. By the way, that business of him scoring goals against Villa, he's now got 9 in 10 Premier League appearances against the villains. He hasn't scored more against any other opponent in the big 5 European leagues in his career. Woof.
Yeah, it felt like quite an important win for Chelsea, who, as we know, have been going through this sticky patch, those back-to-back draws in the league against Everton and against Wolves. And I think going behind, as they did in quite fortuitous circumstances with the Reece James own goal, against the Villa team who've got their tails up, who are playing with much more energy and in a much more compact way, there was a potential for Chelsea to come unstuck again here. And I think particularly given the way that they were labouring in the first half without any kind of attacking focal point. So I think the fact they managed to come through that will do them good, particularly with, as you say, those tricky fixtures to come. I suppose the one downside is more injury problems. N'Golo Kanté going off with what sounds like a recurrence of the problem that had previously kept him out. Thiago Silva going off as well. a step forward in terms of the result and the second half performance, but perhaps a little step back as well on the injury front.
And this was a game, one of the first ones that we heard that Steven Gerrard wasn't going to be in the dugout for Aston Villa. And then came a few more. And if I'm right, I think all of the teams that didn't have their manager on the sidelines ended up losing on Boxing Day.
Do we think Stevie G gets as involved in the game when he's watching it on TV as he does on the touchline? That's what I found myself thinking, watching the game. Is it about time we brought, given that managers not being able to attend games is becoming more and more of a thing, we brought in like remote manager cam so you can just see them at the kind of, you know, the West Midlands Travelodge or something as he sort of hops about his bedroom?
Feels like to me that they should be made to watch with their family, sort of royal family style.
I mean, I would absolutely watch that. I would absolutely watch that.
What other cams would you like to have to enhance your appreciation of the action going on, you know, within that green rectangle?
That's opening a can of worms. But
it's open, baby.
Remember, player cam was a thing for a bit, wasn't it? Everyone got really excited about player cam and then realised
that... You had those dreadful fan cam things as well, where you'd have alternate commentary. Yeah. They were great.
I mean... There are many things to love about the US, but kiss cam must be the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. How about a cam on the actual ball?
Brilliant.
I think we're all hungover enough at this time of year without vomiting in the lounge because we're watching ball cam.
What about a goalkeeper cam? Just to kind of 90 minutes of kind of... With a Mogwai soundtrack of basically... Edison just standing there, maintaining focus.
I'd watch it if it was Aaron Ramsdale. Okay, I bet Aaron Ramsdale for 90 minutes is quite entertaining.
Hey, speaking of Aaron Ramsdale, let's hear what he got up to on Boxing Day in his trip with his friends to Carrow Road.
It's the Paddy Power Football Supporter Support Line. We're talking to Joe in Newcastle and Greg in Norwich. How are you feeling, gents?
Good. Optimistic, Paddy.
But your team's at the bottom of the table. Why are you so happy?
Well, I think I speak for Norwich and Newcastle fans everywhere when I say we really fancy our chances of winning the championship next year.
Silver linings, eh? Just like with Paddy Power's Bet Builder, where you get money back as a free bet if one leg lets you down. Paddy Power applies to pre-match online bet builder bets with minimum 4 legs of at least 1-5 odds each. Max free bet £10 per day. Excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18+.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Here come Arsenal looking for another. Pepe deflected, surely Smith Rowe. It's a 5-star showing for Arsenal.
Woof. Arsenal, 5-0 winners away at Carrow Road. Now, am I right? That's their joint heaviest margin of victory in a Premier League away game ever, level with 6-1 wins over Bury in 99 and Everton in 2009. Who, why, how, Daniel?
Well, I mean, in the score column I wrote, I picked out Martin Ødegaard, who I think probably because he was on loan before and is now a permanent signing, is quite easy to forget how hard that can be sometimes. When a player is on loan, we saw with Jesse Lingard, and Joe Willock is a really good example of this. When they're on loan, they kind of play with this freedom of I'm out to impress everyone. And when that signing then gets made permanent, and Willock's a good example, it can all go a little bit flat because it's both new and yet familiar, and opposition managers know what to expect from you in this team, even though you're a new signing. But Ødegaard has really kicked on in the last few weeks, and I think with Martinelli and Saka and to an extent Smith Rowe, you kind of get these sort of mazy dribblers and pace in behind, whereas Ødegaard seems to be the one that just sort of controls the tempo of that and sometimes even slows it down when it needs to be a little bit less frenetic. And I think Arteta after game described how he's kind of gliding Arsenal through games at the moment, which I really liked.
He's another one with a picture of Jack Grealish in his attic, by the way. He says as many Premier League assists in this match as Grealish has managed all season. Ødegaard, remarkable.
Yeah, he does just look. He looks really good. He looks to have his kind of ability to combine what all those other Arsenal players do. And I think that sometimes works, especially if you're in the centre. You've got pace out wide and you've got a dribbler in Smith Rowe and you've got a finisher in Martinelli, and he seems to have a kind of a little bit of all of them, and is also young. And that's clearly the theme of this Arsenal team, which is on the up.
Do you want to hear an amazing stat? It's about Emil Smith Rowe. He is now coming off the bench to score for the fourth game in a row, right? He's now the fourth top scorer in the Premier League. Smith Rowe, incredible.
And imagine what he could do if he actually started games.
But he can't because Odegaard's so good, is that right?
Yeah, well, why? Why can't they both play?
Well, I think it's more Martinelli who's taking Smith Rowe's place, yeah. In that when Smith Rowe has played with Odegaard, Smith Rowe has played on the left. But both Emil Smith Rowe and Gabriel Martinelli are currently ahead of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang in the pecking order. And another player who I thought it was worth mentioning in terms of having come into the team of late and helped to re-dynamise what Arsenal are doing is Alexandre Lacazette, who is not as sort of starry a name as Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang. If you were sort of constructing a World 11, you'd probably turn to Aubameyang sooner than turning to Lacazette. But I think what he brings to this team is really important, both as sort of as a slightly older head, but also as a centre forward who's happy to play with his back to goal. When you've got so much pace and youth and exuberance around you, it's really important to have that player who other players can play off. And I think whereas Arsenal, when Aubameyang was in the team, you felt that he needed a platform to be constructed for him on which to go and then perform, because basically all he does is cut in from the left and score. Lacazette is much more involved in the build-up play. And I think, as a consequence, with all these young players in the team and playing in this very sort of bright and effervescent way, I think Lacazette is the absolute perfect foil for them all. And he's been another key figure in their recent resurgence.
I noticed on Match of the Day as well that they put up the graphic of results since Aubameyang was stripped of the captaincy and how impressive they look. I do wonder if it spells the beginning of the end for him.
Well, no, he's this year's Ozil, no question. But I looked at that graphic as well and couldn't help but notice the teams that those results had come against. And
true,
thought, well, I feel like we've been down this particular trail before. But Arsenal fans, I mean, you got to love this. They even scored their first penalty of the season, which is remarkable. They're the first time they could successfully converted a penalty. Odegaard for Arsenal, but more Odegaard for Norwich meantime. And particularly, poor Angus Gunn. What time to make your first Premier League start for Norwich? So he ships 5 goals here. Do you recall his last Premier League appearance?
Well, he played for Southampton.
He did.
Oh, it was a 9-0, wasn't it?
I think it was, yeah. I was just about to say, was it the 9-0?
Miserable. Can you imagine? He took 2 years to come back from that and this happened.
When he was at Southampton, I did interview him about his dad and following in his footsteps, and his face lit up about Norwich and the fact that one day he might go back there. And then when I saw it was his first Premier League start, and I must admit, I did think, oh, bless him. Yeah.
All right, better times ahead.
Hey, Aaron Ramsdale had some bad times as well, and look at him now.
That's true.
I mean, you say better times ahead. Maybe for him, maybe not for Norwich. I mean, that kind of bump they got, well, actually in Daniel Farke's last game and then in after Dean Smith took over, has very much gone. They've lost 4 games in a row without scoring a goal. And yeah, I mean, while you could see Newcastle improving enough in January to spark some sort of, at least an attempt at a revival, I don't think the same's true of Norwich. I don't think they've got the money to throw at it, and I don't think they've got the want to throw money at it. And, you know, Smith was appointed, I'm sure, with one eye on next season in mind, but it's quite a long time from November to May if you start losing all your games, as Daniel Farke found. And, yeah, you do kind of wonder whether Smith, because he took that job so quickly after the Villa job. I think it was like a Premier League record for the shortest time between two jobs from a manager sacked. And I do wonder if he maybe could have just, you know, when he was doing well at Villa, Dean Smith for a while was the favourite to be next England manager, which is maybe says more about England's options than anything else. But I do wonder whether he just jumped into that a little bit too quickly.
The honeymoon is over. honeymoon in Norwich. Yeah. Behind Arsenal, meantime, in the top four race, you got Spurs, who are 6 points back, but they have three games in hand. West Ham are 7 points behind. They've played one game less than Arsenal. Man United, meanwhile, are fully 8 points behind the Gunners, but they've also, like Spurs, played three games less. That's, of course, including Monday night's trip to Newcastle. Games in hand, though, I mentally think, oh, well, and I think a lot of people do go, oh, there's potentially that's 9 points there with the three games. But it actually means also a much more congested calendar. So at a time which is proving really difficult for clubs, you're going to have less than ideal circuit. All it means is that basically Arsenal have been able to play their games at a more regular pace so far, and these guys are going to have them all jammed in one place, which doesn't sound that positive, actually.
But Arsenal Wolves is off now, so they've got one that they've got to reschedule too. Yeah.
A bird in the hand, James, is worth two in the bush, or whatever that
well,
that, saying
that's,
actually
no, that's
is.
Precisely it. Yeah. Absolutely. Do you not use that often, Tom? Is that one that's
I don't think I've ever used it before. It's like when you when you say a word for the first time that you've only ever seen written down, and then halfway through saying it you think to yourself, am I doing this right? Hence my hesitancy. Should have said it with more assertiveness. I remember a podcast friend of ours who I was doing a pod with, who I won't name, saying the word segue for the first time, and he pronounced
and he
it Sieg, I think. Because segues are very confusing. I mean, segue as in a segue in a conversation rather than, you know, one of those sort of
you don't see those
transportation
anymore, do you?
Devices. You don't see them so much anymore. No. No. Been usurped by the e-scooter, perhaps.
Yeah, they weren't big on the Christmas list.
And actually, to be honest, e-scooters are an absolute menace. So I say bring back the segues. Team segue. All is forgiven.
Right. Well, they were also quite menacing.
Not least for the guy who designed them, famously.
Well, indeed, yeah. Right. I was trying to Sieg, using the word Sieg, into Spurs Crystal Palace, which has happened 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon. And it looked like Palace might make this one a tricky one for the home side, but then kind of everything happened at once and very much in Spurs' favour. Lucas Moura setting up Harry Kane for a lovely finish. And then scoring a quite magnificent header for the second, after which Wilfried Zaha gets a red card. Remarkable stuff.
Yeah, everything in about, as you say, in about 6 or 7 minutes. I mean, the Zaha sending off was absolutely brainless. I think he was really unlucky to get the first yellow, but having got the first yellow, it seemed pretty obvious that Tottenham had been told by Antonio Conte to get under his skin and try and wind him up, and that's exactly what they did, and just a stupid reaction to get himself sent off. But I really like watching Oliver Skip. I've not seen that much of him since Conte's been there at Tottenham, but he absolutely ran that midfield. He does exactly the same way we said about Ødegaard, it kind of has a bit of every player around him. Skip's the same. He's got that kind of defensive stability of Højbjerg, but he doesn't just pass it sideways and backwards, and, you know, he really tries to progress the ball up the pitch, and yet does it with a real energy that sometimes Tanguy Ndombele lacks, and I think Conte would like to see more of an Ndombele. So when Conte came in, he was really keen to stress, you know, this is a meritocracy now. No one is guaranteed places. It's what you show me. And I think probably more than any other player, Skip has, maybe him and Eric Dier have proven to Conte that they can be kind of staples in this team.
And up front, Daniel, as well, this is the first time in a long time that I can remember that, you know, all three were at it, weren't they? Moura, Kane, Son, they were all at it. And it's been threatening to be this way for a while. And you, under Conte, didn't doubt for a second that he would get them back to this point. But it has taken a bit longer than I think Spurs fans, even they, would care to admit. But yeah, I think this could be a 2022 for Spurs to kick on.
Lovely. I mean, Lucas Moura, though, possibly not your man of the match, but that goal, that header, I'm slightly confused as to why it's not a foul, given that he absolutely destroys Joachim Andersen on his way to connecting with the ball. But it was just magnificent to see.
It's a wonderful goal, and it's Joachim Andersen's own fault for not even attempting to head the ball. He's just sort of cowering beneath it, this towering slab of Scandinavian centre-back, as little Lucas Moura flings himself into the air, and like a proper centre forward's header. And what was nice about it as well was that Lucas was involved in the construction of the move as well on the halfway line with a classic Lucas Moura dribbler. I think he's one of the best dribblers in the world and has been his entire career. But you're used to seeing that from him. You're less used to seeing him finishing things off in that fashion. But he's another player who has benefited from Antonio Conte's arrival. You know, whenever we talk about Spurs in attacking sense, you obviously focus on Harry Kane, Son Heung-min. We knew, or we suspected strongly, that the wing-backs would end up becoming an important part of the way that Spurs approach games, and that's been borne out. But actually Lucas, as sort of the third man in that attack, has been really key. And he's a very streaky player. You know, he'll go sort of four, five, six, seven games without doing anything. But when he's on his game, as he was against Palace, he's absolutely electrifying.
I think it's the wing-back area where he might get reinforcements in January. That's my hunch. I think the way that he wants to play, I think he could do with a bit more competition there.
Yeah, Emerson Royale is not... He's a new signing, but he's not really kicked on. He's really frustrating, and he should be. You feel like he's got the tools to be far better than he, or far more effective than he is. He was actually pretty good against Palace, but it sounds like Mac Doherty is surplus to requirements, and that, as Lindsay says, Conte might want another right wing back.
As regards that top four race, then Spurs looking pretty good. They've now moved clear of West Ham, who are in sixth place, and I think have got lots of other concerns beyond potential top four finishes after their 2-3 defeat at home to Southampton. That's, as I mentioned earlier, four defeats in the last five for the Hammers. And once again, it's not unconnected with the number of absentees that they have at the back.
Yeah, I mean, I think West Ham have obviously got personnel problems in terms of the players who are out. Angelo Ogbonna, Kurt Zouma, Aaron Cresswell, which is practically an entire defence. And I think their absence has clearly been felt. But Mikel Antonio made an interesting point when he spoke about mental fatigue as being a factor. And obviously, as we know, West Ham are involved in multiple competitions and have been doing very well in all of those competitions. But are all those games taking their toll a little bit? And something I wonder about West Ham as well is that they're a great counter-punching team. They're a brilliant counter-attacking team, and they've reserved almost all their best performances for games against the big guns this season. You think about those 2-3-2 wins at home to Liverpool, and then more recently at home to Chelsea. I wonder whether just their whole sort of setup is less well suited to tackling the lesser lights of the division, if you like. But it was interesting to hear Antonio talk about mental fatigue, as if that sort of very impressive first half of the season, coupled, I'm sure, with all the injuries, is perhaps starting to catch up with them.
Mm. Well, Saints, though, that's only the third win in their last 21 games on the road.
Mm.
Yeah, three goals, three shots on target, efficient.
Yeah, and they are a baffling team. They really are. Just when you think you've got them kind of nailed, they go on these weird runs in which, as you say, they've only beaten Watford and Sheffield United away from home in the Premier League in 2021. An absolutely rotten run. And then they go and suddenly look like this brilliant, efficient attacking team, which is, it should be said, with Adam Armstrong in the team, is exactly what they haven't been, because he's taken a huge number of shots without scoring. So, yeah, I having Armando Broya in the team, I think they look better with him in there as a kind of target man, focal point centre forward. I just think if you're not good at taking your chances, if your striker isn't good at taking his chances, which neither Che Adams and Adam Armstrong have been this season, you need a presence up there to bring other people into play.
They do look better with Broya, but my word, do they need to wrap up James Ward-Prowse in cotton wool. I'd be putting everything possible around James Ward-Prowse to stop him getting injured, because if he goes out of this team, they are in deep trouble. I mean, his delivery from set pieces for this led to the winning goal, but his calmness as well for the penalty. He's clearly that leader they need as well out there on the pitch. And I just think if anything happens to him in the next few months, then Hasenhüttl might have a real issue on his hands.
Hopefully better times for West Ham. Midweek, they are due to be playing a Watford team who haven't had any action for absolutely ages. Three matches postponed. The Hornets due to COVID cases. All right, let's next up then wrap it up with a look ahead to what awaits us Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, in association with Paddy Power. And with Paddy Power, if something doesn't go quite to plan, you can get your money back as a free bet if one leg of your bet builder lets you down. Which will give some cheer to all you Hammers fans when David Moyes signs Marouane Fellaini to help with West Ham's latest injury crisis. Pre-match bet builders only get your stake back as a free bet. Minimum 4 plus legs. Maximum free bet is £10. Other T's and C's apply, and please gamble responsibly.
Ooh, listener, from now until New Year's Eve, so Friday, you can sign up for an annual subscription to The Athletic and get 60% off. Boom. £24 for 12 months. That's £2 a month for a year. Sounds like a deal, doesn't it? Get two. Brilliant. Coming up over the next few days in the Premier League, well, Monday night, it's Newcastle Man United, which kind of belongs to the Boxing Day fixtures, but by now, etc. Then on Tuesday, you've got two games called off already. As Lindsay was mentioning, Arsenal against Wolves, Leeds Villa as well. The matches set to take place currently include Crystal Palace against Norwich. That's 3 o'clock on Tuesday. It's been over 25 years since the Canaries beat the Eagles at Selhurst Park. Number one at the time, Tom?
I think it was Fast Love by George Michael, James.
Oh, well, I think you answered that a little too quickly for my liking, Tom Williams. Shall I romp through the rest of the fixtures and you can say which ones you're most excited by? You've got Saints against Spurs. You may recall that fixture last season. 5-2 it finished. Sonny scored 4 goals. And Kane set up all of them as well as scoring another himself. So could be a lot of web-slinging going on down at St Mary's. Watford against West Ham, that's on Tuesday. Daniel, you're heading off to Leicester, Liverpool.
Yes, fingers crossed.
To sample the excellent atmosphere at the King Power. Wednesday, Chelsea scheduled to be playing Brighton and Brentford against Man City. Yikes. All right then. That Spurs Spider-Man thing, that is that all because Tom Holland said that he revealed that he's a Spurs fan, so now, and he did an interview with Sun, and or is it one of those marketing tie-ins like the time that Man United did a special themed, was it Independence Day goal celebration?
I'd forgotten about that. That's a low moment. I'm going to give Spurs the benefit of probably not much doubt and say that it wasn't an official tie-in, I hope.
Right.
But I did enjoy, I think it was Davinson Sanchez's face at the back of the celebration, which was classic sort of forced fun at an office Christmas party. Photo face, which is superb.
To be fair, if you scroll on from that freeze frame, he does get into it after.
I'm choosing.
I think he was just focusing
on
which fingers to position in which in which place. But anyway, all right. Well, Daniel, as I say, you're heading to Leicester Liverpool for a rematch of that extraordinary Carabao Cup quarter-final. 3-3 that finished after Leicester were 3-1 up. Leicester, by the way, are all the way down in 10th place now, and they'll be taking on a very rested Liverpool side.
Yeah, I mean, clearly, as with every game at the moment, COVID-dependent, but also Liverpool players-dependent, and we're not quite sure which players will be available for Liverpool. You assume that Jurgen Klopp would like to get the most out of Mohamed Salah and Sadio Mane as he can before AFCON, but to kind of segue into that slightly, it now sounds as if players are going to be allowed to delay going to AFCON by 4 or 5 days. There was a theory that this might be the last game for Salah and Mane, but it now appears that CAF has probably in their wisdom, I think, has allowed players to leave as late as January the 3rd for the tournament, which just buys them a little bit more goodwill, because to kind of repeat what I said at the top of the show, there is a fear within CAF that high-profile players may decide to not go to that tournament in the current climate.
Mm, absolutely. All right. Well, that should be a cracker. What else do you think is going to be particularly worth tuning in for this midweek? Lindsay, what are you up to?
Well, I'm at Brentford Man City.
Are you?
The game that kicks off a bit earlier than that is Chelsea Brighton. And I think that's really of interest, because if Lukaku starts in that game and if he can kick on, we might see the start of a charge from Chelsea to try and play catch up with the likes of Liverpool. Because at the moment, I think Arsenal will fancy themselves to nip third as it stands. So, yeah, Chelsea
really?
Against Brighton. Yeah, I think given the score lines that they've had and the consistency they've shown, yeah, they won't just be talking about a top four finish at the minute. I think they might even be talking about top three. So Chelsea need to do something about that. And I think Brighton will be good opposition for them. The couple of really good goals that we saw in the game against Brentford from them.
Mm.
So, yeah, I'm quite looking forward to hearing how that goes. And Brentford City, I'm just wondering how many hands I need to look at for counting up the numbers
right,
of goals.
The goals.
Yeah.
Take your shoes off as well.
Honourable mention for the haven't you got the manager that we should have derby between Everton and Newcastle on Thursday night as well. I think if both clubs had their time again, then Everton would probably think that Eddie Howe might do a better job for what they want than Rafa Benitez. And I think Newcastle fans would probably be very happy to have Rafa Benitez as their manager. So that's a kind of interesting political game, I suppose.
Interesting. Yeah, it was. You mentioned the Brighton goals. The Trossard, how would you describe that? It wasn't a chip. It was kind of like a volleyed chip? Or
it was like a volleyed lob. Volleyed
good
lob,
time.
I would say.
Good time.
A lobby.
You speak football. Yeah.
There was
Tom.
A bit of scoop volley. Scoop volley going on.
Scoop volley?
Yeah.
That sounds like playground talk to me.
Mm.
Scoop and volley. The second Brighton goal was a really nice goal as well. Neil Mopé bending one in. Top right. And I think given Brighton's well-documented XG problems, I think when Neil Mopay is fit and firing, I think that's very helpful. But yeah, just to pick up on what Lindsay was saying, I think this is a really crucial part of the season for Chelsea, who've got a game against Liverpool at the weekend, who've got these injuries starting to bite, who lose Edouard Mendy, their goalkeeper, to Senegal's campaign in the African Cup of Nations, and coming up against a Brighton team who have stopped the rot after, what was it, 11 games without a win or something, without win over Brentford. So I think this is a pivotal moment in Chelsea's title challenge, and it could be the case that Romelu Lukaku has come back to fitness and back into the team at just the right time.
Yeah, indeed so. What about Watford West Ham on Tuesday afternoon? How is it going to be for Watford, who haven't picked up a point since November, largely because they haven't really played a game, I don't think, since November, more or less. The last three matches postponed due to COVID cases. They had lost four straight before that, though. But that game is apparently set to go ahead.
Yeah, I got last time I talked about Watford on here, I got told off by Watford supporters for suggesting that Claudio Ranieri should be a little bit fearful given Watford's tendency to have at least three managers every season. Fans say they are really happy with Ranieri. That isn't always that doesn't always matter at Watford, obviously. If the club decide, the club decide. But yeah, it feels a massive game for Watford, this, because if you come back having had that time, not time off, because obviously it's COVID suspensions, but if you come back and then lose by 2 or 3 to West Ham at home, everything does begin to feel a little bit forlorn.
It matters more in terms of performance, though, than result. I don't think they go into this game against West Ham, who now will have a bit more of a point to prove, having been defeated by Southampton. I don't think it's necessarily result-based on this one, but I think it's performance-based that they need to see something there.
And yeah, and just to sort of follow on from that, I think an unfortunate element of those postponements for Watford was that they were all... they all look like potentially winnable games, away at Burnley, home to Crystal Palace, away at Wolves, perhaps a little bit less winnable looking given Wolves' recent form. But you know, Watford had come through a trickier period fixture-wise prior to that. You know, they'd played Chelsea, they'd played City, and would probably have had that run of games earmarked as, right, this is the moment when all the pieces of the Claudio Ranieri puzzle are going to fall into place. So, I think that need to get points on the board is now even greater for having, you know, having spent the last three game weeks just sitting on their hands, basically.
2 points above the drop zone at the moment, but of course the table a bit hard to read given the extraordinary imbalance in the number of fixtures played. Crikey. Well, all that action coming up, plus, as Daniel was mentioning, exciting fixtures on Thursday as well, as we head towards the new year. That wraps it up, I think, for this Totally Football show, unless there's anything else anybody wants to pitch in.
Kick-off times are a bit confusing, aren't they? 3 o'clock games on Tuesday. Is this what time the games always kick off? Have I just forgotten the sort of...
Well, I think Tuesday's a holiday, no, because...
Boxing Day... That's just because of how Christmas has fallen this year.
Yeah.
I can see a lot of football fans being very confused on Tuesday afternoon at the realisation that there are three games, COVID pending, all kicking off at
just
the same time.
Confused anyway.
I'm sort of annoyed that there are three at 3 o'clock and not one at 5:30. If you're going to have it effectively as a weekend day in terms of fixtures, why have we got three kick off at the same time at all? That then leads to people screaming at me about fans attending matches.
No, absolutely. And is there not a case that much as the railway system is just better under a central government, you know, you can't leave kind of something like public transport to be organised by on the basis of profit motives. Equally, the fixture schedule should be decided by a national committee, perhaps composed of us, I don't know, rather than left to the broadcaster's whims.
I'm saying is I think you could have Watford West Ham at 5:30 and I would watch it, which is probably not how they've decided it.
No, indeed not. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of today's Totally Football show. There's one more of these before the end of this year, and it's coming up on Thursday. So perhaps you'll join us for that, listener. For now, it's many, many thanks to Daniel Surridge, Tom Williams, and to Lindsay Hooper, and to producer Charlie, and yes, you, listener, who's getting to that. Hope you all have a sensational week, and catch up with you soon. And for anyone who's not going to be here on Thursday, have a happy new year from everyone at Totally.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Listen ad-free on the Athletic app and discover bonus content by following the Athletic UK Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. Find out the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally. The Totally Football Show is an Athletic Media Company production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.